All right, members, I think we'll get started here. We have, a really exciting day before us, so why don't we get on with it. Just one housekeeping thing before we start. On Thursday, as probably many of you know, we are going to be hearing the Freedom to Breathe Act. And any amendments, and I'll try to make this announcement at the end too. If you have amendments, we are going to use the 24-hour rule on this. So if you have amendments, please get them in by tomorrow at 2:15, just for administrative efficiency. So that would be great. We are going to kind of start a part of our discussion about health care reform that'll, I think, be on everybody's minds as we move forward here. And to do that, we're going to try to paint a bigger picture of what's going on maybe nationally or some other ideas that are out there that can help focus our discussion, maybe give us some ideas and provoke some new thinking about how our healthcare system works and maybe what we can do to make it work better. And to do that, we have some, I think, really exciting speakers today to talk to us. And the first is Senator Dave Durenberger from the National Institute of Health Policy. Senator Durenberger, if you want to come up to the table and identify yourself, and then let us know what's on your mind. And thank you for coming. We're really honored to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the gentlemen and women, thanks very much for the opportunity to be here. I'm Dave Durenberger, and I'm a senior health policy fellow at the University of St. Thomas. And I talked to Paul at the chairman, I'm the chairman, on the telephone, and he said, let's do some basics, and then we'll get to the experts. So the experts will follow me. I'm going to do some basics based on the experience, and I want to tell you that I didn't think about this until I prepared this, but this month I am celebrating my 40th anniversary of this place, because 40 years ago in January of 67, my law partner took office as governor, and he stuck me with the job of being chief of staff. And so I was, some of you may be starting this year, you're 40 years ahead of me, because you're still objective about all of this sort of thing. So that's the background. Here's what I'd love to talk to you about today, these four things: the health system, role of government, role of politics, and something I call, or want to call, heirs to a tradition. So let's just talk first about, and again, if this is too basic, Mr. Chairman, stop me, so that's the way I interpret your instructions. It really is, if you want to think about health policy, you better put it in the context of the United States of America and not some other place, because even though hospitals may look the same in some countries, doctors may be the same in a lot of countries, we do have a health care system that is quite different. And on purpose, I put up here an African clinic because of the similarities. I just noticed that docs are going on strike in Zimbabwe because they can't get more than a $50 a year or $50 a month pay. So you can understand there's a difference in that part of the world. There's very little difference if you go to Germany or the Children's Hospital in Winnipeg, and if you go to Dubai and Healthcare City, they're probably way ahead of us already. But one of the areas that is instructive about the U.S. Healthcare system is that we spend twice as much money as the average of all other developed countries in the world. If you look at a country that is comparable to us in the amount of money we spend on other things, like all goods and services, Japan, you can see they're spending $2,139 against our $5,635, and this is 2 or 3 year old statistics. I do this one just so you can feel good about the fact that a rising tide lifts all boats, and it just keeps going and going and going. Right in the middle of that, 1980 is about the size of the bill when I took office in the United States Senate. And you can be off to the right about the time some of you get ready to retire what the bill is going to be. This is another way of expressing it in terms of premium costs. You go back to 1988, it was like at 12% a year, went way down to the middle 90s. Largely through a lot of managed care activity, went right back up again after the managed care company, national managed care company, the figures started accommodating the doctors and hospitals demand, and now it's still at 7.7%. Ask yourself the question why, and I'm going to do this simplistically because this best sums up all of my experiences. Paul Starr wrote the book. This is called The Logic of Healthcare Reform, but he really wrote the gospel, if you will, with a small g, on the healthcare system called The Social Transformation of American Medicine. And it's very, very clear, when you spend any time at all in this business, and you know that the incentives are all wrong in this system. We can perform miracles, but we can't make them available to everybody in this country. So that's just sort of part of the reality. Here's another way to look at it. You may believe you've been overcharged, but remember you're over-medicated. And those of you who have time to watch television between 5:30 and 6 every day, you know what I am talking about. There's more drug advertising than there is news or whatever else goes on between 5:30 and... Here's another way of looking at it. You know this as Maple Grove. You know this as, why do we need 2 children's hospitals in a community our size? You know this as, why does Center Care want to keep a line out of St. Cloud? You know this as, you know, the drug advertising. You know that this as the efforts on the part of, let's just say hypothetically, oncologists or gastroenterologists or whoever it is, to get kind of a monopoly in Minnesota. Whatever it may be, you know this if things like physician-owned hospitals and things like that. And I don't intend to deprecate any of that. It's just sort of like the reality with which we live. And another reality is that a lot of people blind to what's really going on believe we have the best healthcare system in the world. And this is what the Institute of Medicine has consistently said about the U.S. healthcare system, the highly fragmented cottage industry. You've seen a lot of this before. Go right to the bottom line. It lacks a value orientation. And for those of you this year, and it's a pleasure to open up the paper in the morning and see how you're thinking, but to see that people are thinking about value in healthcare after all of these years, particularly in a body like this, in a state like this, is really very, very heartwarming. But that's the Institute of Medicine. This is just my own personal summary, because it's a whole set of issues with which these are all policy issues, and you will at one time or another you're going to face every one of these issues. The patient safety issues you know about. Minnesota hospitals, for example, are a leader in reporting on themselves on adverse events that occur in hospitals. You read about that a couple of weeks ago, but it is a reality. It is just a reality. Nobody else could stay in business as long as they do with the accident rates or with the safety rates and so forth that they have. The little known fact is employee safety is just about the same thing. Two of the most unsafe workplaces in Minnesota or America today are hospitals and nursing homes. And yet that's the place where we go for care. The disparities in quality and practice and access and access to chronic illness prevention, all of that is just a reality that everyone struggles to deal with. Medical liability reform, we haven't tried to change. We've tried to change that system every year, but we haven't changed it in a long time. Because medicine is still the only place in which one part of the medical professions have a monopoly on information, it still takes 17 years from the time some new discovery comes on the scene and the time that it is commonly adopted in practice. It's now beyond the ability of any human physician to know what he or she really needs to know. And yet the difficulty of transforming to the information age is a challenge. Professions are still operating in the guild, and there's little question about that. You will face that at a variety of times, at a variety of places. The capacity productivity problems on a scale, if Six Sigma is perfection, anesthesiology is like 5, and everything else is about a 1.5 or something like that on an efficiency or perfection. Live in a nation which obesity is the number one public health problem, and you scratch your head and say, holy cow, you know, what are we going to do? 3% of the gross domestic product goes into transaction costs. That doesn't happen in any other country in the world, only in America, because we have a fetish for choice and insurance and so forth. We have 46 million uninsured. This is much more to be said, but I'll leave it to others to get to that. The role of government. Again, this is I've now proved I have a 40-year learning curve. If you look at health broadly, the way people in public health or people in the real world will look at health, and you look at health policy in every other country in the world, you see healthy people, healthy communities, housing, environment, and medical and supportive services. In the United States, we have medicalized the entire healthcare system. Everything is thought about in terms of healthcare, or in terms of medicine. Insurance is mainly reimbursement for medical expenditures. Those who advocate mental health parity, thinking about mental health as, you know, a medical problem solely, and we have to act. People think about prevention, let's put it into an insurance plan and things like that. We have totally medicalized everything in this country, all very, very well-intentioned over strong. But if you look at it as a policy and you compare yourself with other countries and you ask, why have some of the other countries been more successful than we? Why is the health of Brits and the health of Canadians and people like that better overall than our health? They have a different set of goals. I mean, policy makers have a different set of goals and a broader set of challenges, and they're less segmented and divided in how they approach it. Quickly, this is the history. State government has always regulated markets, state legislated medical monopoly from the beginning. Before there were all the lobbyists and things like that, there was a medical association and a variety of medical associations who mandated that their services be made part of health insurance in order to enable the highest possible price for the services, to increase the price of any substitute so you wouldn't substitute one for the other, so there would be limited entry and information. I put this here because I learned this secondarily. You get this from any health economist can walk you through this. And if you want to know why are there no health markets in this country that function, it's largely because the markets have been regulated by your predecessors at a state level at the request of the people in the profession. Limited entry and information, advertising prohibition. And then over time, this war by the solo practitioners on group practice, which used to play out in forums like this back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and even into the 60s, the attacks on group health and on multi-specialty group practices on HMOs and things like that. Today, as a result, 50% of all physicians in America are solo practitioners. 90% practice in groups of less than 10. So is there a reason for this at a time when you want care coordination, you find the complications of access to information? This is historic. I mean, it has risen because of policy judgments taken by a wide variety of people, all for very good reasons. And then there's state legislated insurance market as well, and you know this is part of your job. The national government's task has been to subsidize services and access. The national government has been largely responsible for what we now call universal coverage. Put a hospital in every town through, at least every town that has a high school, called Hill-Burton, clinical access through Medicare and Medicaid, research through the National Institute of Health Policy, and a variety of tax deductions, education through capitation, cross-subsidies, Medicare, that IME is indirect medical education. The Medicare program puts about $7 billion a year into academic medical centers and into teaching hospitals. It puts an equivalent amount of money into what's called disproportionate care hospitals. This is money that doesn't go to Medicare beneficiaries. It goes to teaching hospitals and academic medical centers to, quote, support either education or teaching hospitals located in communities with a disproportionate share of poor people. You allocate some of that money through the Medicaid program, the Medicaid DISH program. There's nothing directly, and most of it is all of the data that the analysts give us at MedPAC, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, says that about a half of the money or a third of the money for medical education actually goes to medical education. The rest of it largely is supporting institutions. Again, it's been there for a long time, hard to change. There's institutional reasons why these things are hard to change. Insurance, tax-free, employer-paid health premiums, and then there's direct provision of care. But this is the way in which the national government fostered access to health care. So ask yourself about market dysfunction. Quality, the doctor knows best. Cost is an indemnity. Accountability is what you do, not how well you do it. Price reflects a lot of things. You talk about transparency and pricing. There really is no such thing except in the drugstore, I guess, when you walk around and look at prices on DayQuil and NyQuil and things like that. If you go into a hospital, it is impossible for any hospital in any one of our communities to tell us what things actually cost. Whether it's possible or not for drug companies to tell us what things actually cost, I don't know. I just know they won't tell us, and there is no way that you're ever going to find out, because, again, it's so difficult to get markets to work in this country, And in other countries, they simply regulate the prices, and they just tell the drug companies, that's all we're going to pay for all of these drugs. So we don't really know what they cost. Information in the hands of doctors, consumer choice of doctors and services. The result is unhealthy people and unhealthy expectations. We are all expecting so much for our money in this system. Federalism. The states as laboratories of change. Universal coverage didn't start at the it talked about at the national level, never happened. Hawaii in 1974 was the first state to go to universal coverage. Nobody else has done it, and Minnesota's come closest to it at about 7%. Minnesota basically invented the HMO and the co-op approach. Changes in how we pay, all of the current payments at Medicare level, all started in states like in New Jersey and Maryland. The tobacco suit started in Minnesota. Chemical dependency treatment, things like that, started in Minnesota. We could go on and on with examples like this, but I just take one PowerPoint to prove to you that a lot of the invention, if you will, in the healthcare system or healthcare policy has started at the state level. But it didn't necessarily end up at the state level being policy across this country. On the national level, the national government, in my experience, is dealt largely with silver bullets. Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Clinton were all for universal coverage. On or about my watch, we got into supply regulation. We created certificate of need and health systems agencies and things like that. We counted all the beds in the community and said, let's close Mount Sinai Hospital because it's got the fewest occupied beds in a year or something like that. A regulatory approach to bringing costs down by trying to regulate prices didn't work. By trying to regulate supply, didn't work. President Reagan, interestingly, brought us a couple of things. Brought us price regulation through the hospital prospective payments and the physician prospective payments. But he also did, he was the last president to say, wait a minute, there's 50 states here, and they gave a limited amount of power to the national government, which has since been expanded, but it is still a federal system. And he proposed, for example, that we swap the federal government would take on responsibility for access to long-term care, and the states would take the low-income mom kids health care access. He also uniquely took all the health and social programs that had accumulated by 1982, put them into a block grant, and said to the states, "You buy back all this stuff got invented in states anyway. I'm going to let you buy back, you know, all of those programs. And if you agree to take on responsibility of the programs, we'll get out of the excise tax business at the federal level and leave that source of revenue to you to pay for this sort of thing." The last time we had a creative look at the federal-state relationship. We then, in the 90s, went to managed care and competition, and now we're into consumer-driven health care. Here's the next new federalism, which nobody's talking about, but since the chairman asked, I'll give it to you. National rules, local markets, private contracts. If we had national rules for insurance, if we had national antitrust rules, if we had national rules generally, local markets would all work a lot better than 50-state markets. If we had private contracts, for whether it's for insurance or anything else, that people would have to honor, we wouldn't have this notion that, you know, if there's a possibility that my life can be saved by, then it must be in my contract in some way. The second thing is the national income security policy, which would replace all of the current income security programs. Social Security was invented in 1935 and hasn't been changed, except it's been modified in terms of the eligibility. Medicare, Medicaid in 1960. We're still building a national income security structure on programs that are outdated. And we have no national policy. So we spend a lot of money on tax subsidies for the wealthy now, called health savings accounts, and we complain about the fact we have 46 million. uninsured, and we don't have any money to spend on the uninsured. There's an inconsistency that allows ideology, in most cases, whether it's to the left or to the right, to always trump logic in this system. And then national research, safety and efficacy, you don't have to do this 50 times over. And then the importance of state's role in health and human services. I mean, Reagan was right. This should be our responsibility in places like Minnesota because we are much more creative. This is just a picture, so hopefully some of you get into this sort of thing will remember, and that is a way to look at income security policy. The best income security policy any nation can have is a national government with a healthy that promotes a healthy economy. Don't get in the way of a healthy economy because that's what we all depend on for earnings through jobs. That's That's your basic income security policy. Then you have to have a tax policy that allows people who earn to save. And you need to protect that with private insurance and some form of social insurance, because not everyone will have the capacity and gifts in the economy and things like that to care for themselves. And then at the bottom, the so-called safety net, the one that's invented by the states, closest to the states, is public assistance. Usually it was a local government responsibility, now it's a combination of state and local. Quickly, the role of politics. I put Pete Benner in here because he's the first guy that made me realize that when you get to a certain point in time in a society, when the cost of something that I don't benefit from get to a certain level, I demand responsibility from everybody else, i.e., in any given year, 18% of the people have been in a hospital or some serious problem, and 82% have not. And if year after year after year, the 82% are paying increasing premiums, but they're not getting any service, they're going to start saying, I want some responsibility out of whether it's obesity, smoking, you know, whatever you want to call it. We have this natural instinct. We don't have to be a Republican to have this kind of an instinct. This responsibility, accountability instinct is something we all enjoy. And so that's it. Again, politics. If there's a party that stands for universal coverage, traditionally it's been the Democratic Party, and Bill Clinton was the last to affirm that, but there's sort of a long line. The last Republican, I think, was Richard Nixon. President Bush has a different approach to the issue, which is largely tax spending. The tax subsidies that come off, because they, in large part, they come off budget. They fortify the notion of the ownership society. They fortify the notion of individual responsibility. You make a decision. Your employer makes a decision. You live with that decision. You pay for that decision and so forth. It's sort of like one person, basically, at a time. It is also his philosophy and that of Republicans, currently not necessarily all Republicans, that we should privatize the entire system. Medicare should be privatized. Medicaid should be privatized. Movement and managed care health plans and so forth. But there is a distinction that does not apply to all Democrats and all Republicans. I'm simply saying traditionally you're going to find this kind of a divide. We experienced it in 1990 on the Pepper Commission, the first time we ever had equal numbers of Democrats and senators from the House and Senate on a commission. We were asked to deal with long-term care, and we were almost unanimous to say long-term care is an insurable event. It does not happen to everybody. We need to use an insurance system, not a welfare system, for people in need of long-term care. And the question is, how do you combine private and social insurance? That moves the Medicaid money to the state. In other words, for the moms and the kids and the working poor. And that was a Democrat-Republican, we all agreed. Pete Strzok, for some reason, or that I thought it was. But on the medical care side, we divided 8-7 because Jay Rockefeller, our chair, insisted on a mandate that employers play in the system. And Republicans said, if unless you get the cost under control, what good is it to have universal coverage? This is the last effort at bipartisanship, and there isn't a Democrat in this picture other than John Breaux, who's no longer in office. This is the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, which controls practically everything that's going on nationally now in health policy. Premium-related or income-related premium financing in Part B of Medicare. The Medicare Advantage versus the single payer. Here is where the health insurance plans are, by policy, being asked to take over the Medicare program. And currently, we are paying private health insurance plans somewhere between, on average, $1.16 and $1.21 on the payments we currently make to doctors and hospitals in order to run the Medicare program. What we're looking for in that, of course, is care coordination, a lot of other things. And so far, I know what we've been getting is added benefits and lower premiums for a lot of people. This is costing a lot of money because it's Medicare dollars going into paying for doctors and hospitals through private insurance. And is it the way to go? We will have, I mean, that's the test that it will be put to over time. You know about prescription drugs, Social Security privatization simply means a big social insurance system costing $370 billion this year will be a private insurance system, unless the Democrats are in office a long time and don't like, but whatever. Then there's HSAs and consumer-driven health care. So this is where we are at today. Now, to the finale, we are heirs to a tradition because we want to only get to the tradition behind me. But I do have to start with people, because those are the folks that put you here, they are the folks that kept me here for three terms. And they really spoke in 2006. And they didn't just shift from one party to the other, although I would say they used one party to beat up on the other, just like they did when Rudy and I got elected a long time ago. But you're coming out of it very differently, I think, this time, because I've never quite sensed so much. You know, these problems are tough enough so that we don't work on them together, they aren't going to get solved. Attitude, and you sense that to a degree at the national level, and I sort of like reading between the lines, sense that here, and I say, hooray, you know, as a Dominican, I love that. Because what people told us when we did this for the governor 4 years ago, the 18 of us, they said, if you want to lower the cost, keep, you know, encourage people to stay healthy. If you want to find out where the real problems are, look at community. And the best example I ever remember being given was the woman who says, I'm a kindergarten teacher, and I'll bet you time and time again, I see behavioral problems before anybody else in the community sees them. And a five-year-old kid coming out of a dysfunctional situation. But nobody else, you know, the health insurance supposed to take care of these sort of things. You know, it's not the way ordinary people look at these sort of things. Long-term care, behavioral health, mental health. A lot of these are community problems. Go up to Moose Lake, go up to other places I've been in this community, in this state. And people are thinking this way all of the time. First person who said, get Mountain Dew out of a pop machine, you know, was some citizen in some little town, you know. And now, it's coming out of the slowly. They pay so much money to these colleges and so forth, it's hard to get them out of the college level. But, you know, this is ordinary Minnesotans. I've got to tell you, Mr. Chairman, this is the most exciting thing 4 years ago I've ever been involved in. It's just healthy people, healthy communities, and a healthy system. And this is a healthy system. Put us in the driver's seat. Don't keep this information away from us. Trust us. Trust us to know how to use information. Fully disclose cost and quality, and we together will reduce the cost in the healthcare system. Give us incentives to encourage health. This is really an interesting one, which is they said universal coverage ain't going to work in healthcare any more than it does in automobiles. It's universal participation we need. Every American coming, whether it's they just arrived here from Somalia, they just came from the reservation to the city, they just, whatever the case may be, it's ordinary people getting lost in the medical system. They need a sense of participation is the word that we kept hearing, not quote coverage. The new model of education and the one the governor is encouraging you to already attack is overhead administration, take on that 3%. So I wanted to start the heirs to the tradition right there. And then I wanted to go to this little map because this is a database map on high value health care. And it is unique to the way medicine is practiced in Hawaii, in the Pacific Northwest, in the Intermountain region of Utah, in the upper Midwest, and in New England. Medicine is practiced differently from the way it is in the rest of the country. This is a reality, and the people that did it up here are the heirs of are the tradition to which current practitioners are heirs. It happens that much of this is not for profit. There is in a non-profit tradition a sense of stewardship that doesn't exist in a for-profit healthcare system. Stewardship is important because it is about community. You can hassle over community benefit and accountability all you want, but a mission-driven organization has a stewardship and it has a sense of accountability that we're trying to kind of like knock out of it now by saying, you know, buy this program, that program, and other programs. We have a different tradition. I just picked on two guys from Le Sueur who went to Rochester, but George Menninger, who founded the Menninger Institute, wrote a letter to his sons on a train after he left Rochester in 1906. And he said, I have been to see the Brothers Mayo, and I have seen the future. There is something about group practice, medical specialty groups, whatever you want to call it. There's something about the co-op tradition. There's something about people working together to try to solve these problems that is unique to that community I just showed you. Here are the results of that. If you look at this is in the upper left-hand corner would be high value, low cost. And the lower right-hand corner would be high cost, low value for money, measured by quality measurement. And you can see New Hampshire, Utah, Vermont, Maine, North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Oregon, and so forth in that upper left-hand. And you know what we're doing with our national health care system. We're moving dollars from the left to the right. We're moving dollars from the upper left to the lower right. We're taking the money out of Minnesota, and we're sending it to Louisiana, Texas, California, Mississippi, Oklahoma, and that's not right. But it's hard, very hard, to change. But people who are in the professions in Minnesota are waiting for the system to change, because if they can be rewarded for being heirs to this tradition, they take it seriously. They are heirs to the tradition. I had somebody help me figure this out, but if every Medicare beneficiary in the U.S. received the quality of care at the cost of Medicare in Minnesota, we could extend the life of the Medicare program, that is the national program, by 100 years. That's how much money is in value-based medicine. These are some of the institutions that are working for you and have been working for you over a long period of time. Minnesota Community of Measurement, the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, the Wisconsin Quality for Healthcare, or Collaborative for Healthcare Quality, that's all docs. That's all doctor groups, like I was talking about earlier, who decided they're going to report on themselves as a way of self-improvement. And then Minnesota Advantage Program and so forth. So it's not like we're starting from scratch. The program that I run at St. Thomas, which is the participants, there are 38 healthcare organizations, all kinds of different stakeholders, covers seven or eight states in the upper Midwest. All of these people are the heirs of the tradition. Tom, I didn't tell you I was going to do this. But on the value premise, I'm going to quote a great American who happens to be from Duluth. It's easier to buy insurance for the 7% uninsured than it is to assure the 93% with insurance that they get their money's worth. We measure progress in healthcare reform by access to insurance, quality of care delivery, and cost containment. It's not just about providing access to a broken system. All three need to be addressed. And that's the reality of your challenge. It's not one or the other. There's a lot of people who want it to be universal coverage, and there's a lot of people who want blah, blah, blah. You know, this is our history. That's why I went through this little bit of a lesson. Your challenge is to find a way to set priorities and to try to move all three of those policy goals ahead simultaneously. People like me are just here, Mr. Chairman, to help you. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, too, and I think that was very helpful. Why don't we take one or two questions if members have questions, and then we can just in terms of time. But are there any particular questions that anybody has around the table? All right. Well, well done. Thank you. The next, Peter Hutchinson and Dr. Maureen Reed are going to come up and kind of give some of their perspectives as well. And thank you for coming, too.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Peter Hutchinson, and with me is Dr. Maureen Reed. You may have known us as the Independence Party candidates for governor and lieutenant governor in the last election. We'd like to be known that way, by the way. Only 140,000 of you figured it out, but we're, you know, always optimistic. One of the thrills, as you know, about running for office is you get to talk to the people in Minnesota about what they care about. And we spent virtually the whole last year wandering around Minnesota talking to people about what they care, where their passions were. And I can tell you unequivocally that in every single conversation but one, which I don't want to go into, health care came up, often first, and often very personal, very personal. The employer who's on the verge of losing his business, the family that's on the verge of losing their income, the government worker who's on the verge of losing their program, the school teacher who can't quite figure out how to stay in teaching, and on and on and on. And the message we want to bring to you today, which is really a consequence of what we heard, is to reinforce what Dave Durenberger just said. We have an incredible obligation in front of us if we're going to do something that is going to help secure the future of this state. That's the tough news. The great news is we have a fantastic opportunity. One of the best opportunities we've had since I've lived in Minnesota, which is pretty much my whole life. You have before you this year, in an unprecedented way, an access to resources that we've never seen that could, if you chose to, be applied to truly transforming healthcare. And what we'd like to do in our little time with you today is set it up a little bit for you. Describe one approach to transforming healthcare. We're not going to claim it's the only one, the best one, the most fantastic, but it's one approach as a way to help you think about what could be. Because if we don't imagine what could be, we're never going to get there. We're going to end up taking these little tiny steps to nowhere. And 10 years from now, we'll be back, and we won't even be having this conversation because we'll be so broke. We won't be in a position to put it all back together. You have a handout that we supplied for the committee. We're going to use that as a point of reference for what we talk about today. I want to start with this key point. Healthcare is the greatest economic, personal, safety, security threat to this state. If we don't take that away from this conversation and get the sense of urgency that that represents, that we're in a lot of trouble. Just think about it from the point of view of the budget that you all have to try to put together this year. Rising health care costs sucked up all the money. It's already gone. And the next biennium, it'll be the same thing, only worse. And the biennium after that, the same thing, only worse. It's why there isn't money for schools or parks or the environment. It's because the public side of the cost of health care is eating everything up. But that's the wonky side of this stuff. I want to tell you a story about being in front of a group of about 150 folks back in the campaign, and I said to them, how many of you got a raise this year? Every hand in the room went up. I said, how many of you are taking more money home? No hands went up. All of that so-called raise was sucked up in the premium and the deductibles and the co-pays. Folks are not being better off, even though we're in a pretty good economy. That said it all to me. From that moment forward, it was so clear that healthcare transformation, healthcare reform is what we needed to be focused on. The second thing I just want to leave with you as you think about this today is we actually don't have a healthcare system. We have a sick care system. It's just what Senator Durnberger was saying. This system is specifically designed to deal with illness, not to prevent it. It's specifically designed to treat us well when we're already sick, but not do very much to keep us from getting there. And if we don't step back from the intricacies of the problems of treating people who are ill, we're not going to get about the business of trying to keep people well. And there's no question that's the best investment over the long run. It'll save us the most money, and it'll give us the greatest economic freedom. Now, what do we know? I'm just going to set up a few more facts, and then Maureen is going to do what she loves to do, which is give you those 6 prescriptions, which only a doctor gets to do. See, I'm not a doc, so it's illegal for me. Another key fact, 20% of all the money in healthcare is in overhead administration, whatever you want to call it. What I call it is all the letters I get every week to say this is not a bill.
Yeah.
All the work that goes into producing that is not creating any value for me. It's not making my kids better or well or anything else. All of the complexity of getting doctors certified and licensed and relicensed and recertified, all the supervision and resupervision and checking and rechecking that goes into deciding what kind of medical care people can get, all of these things are adding enormous cost to a system without creating any additional value. These costs are, in some ways, are the easy target, but they're hard to get at. We want to talk more about that in just a second. The second thing is the quality of the care we get. One of the biggest revelations for me when I read Senator Durnberger's report from the Citizens Forum was that the percentage of the time that we don't get best care. In diabetes in this state, not in some other state, the odds of you getting the complete best care you're supposed to get if you got diabetes are only about 1 in 4. That means 75% of the time you don't get the best deal. Well, think about that. You would never accept that in anything else, and yet we're living with it every day when it comes to medicine. So the second biggest opportunity we have is to improve the quality of the care, which will also improve the cost. Because second-rate care leads to more care because of complications and progression of disease and coming back to get things fixed. If we get it done right the first time, it might even be worth paying more because it'll save us money in the long run. One interesting fact that I stumbled across when we were doing the research on this came out of a federal study that reported that 20% of all the medical tests that are done in medicine are done because the doctors can't find the results of the last test. That, too, is not adding to the quality of the medical outcome, but we pay for it. Thirdly, chronic disease. 5 diseases consume 70-80% of all the money in healthcare: diabetes, heart disease, cancer, asthma, and other chronic diseases. And there's a little chart in here from the Medical Association. I think it's very powerful to realize that these 5 things, if we provide, you know, get a concerted effort, we focus our attention on these 5 diseases, we could actually get the kind of both quality savings, quality improvements we want, but also the financial savings. One thing to think about: diabetes, heart disease, cancer, asthma, and so on, is the behavioral component of every one of those diseases. They're all preventable. They're all susceptible to our personal behavior, and yet those five things are the drivers. Economics. 40 to 50% of all the bankruptcies in Minnesota are tied to personal bankruptcies, are tied to medical costs. State and local governments are the collectively are the largest purchasers of health care in this state. About 25% of the total that's spent on health care in Minnesota is spent through state and local government. It's about $8 billion a year. It's a lot of money. And as a consequence, health care, as you'll discover if you haven't gotten into the budget yet, is in competition with everything else in the budget. Absolutely everything else. The uninsured. You already know that 7-8% of our folks are uninsured. You probably already know that 60% of the uninsured are already eligible for some program that we already have on the books. Most of the rest could afford insurance but are choosing not to have it. Most of those folks are like my kids who think they'll never get sick, and so I've imposed health insurance on my kids. Think of that as a government top-down program. They don't really understand yet why they need it, and so we have a mandate in our family. When you turn 25, you will have health care. But the consequences of not having it are that the rest of us pay for it. And as Senator Durenberger mentioned, the last thing is long-term care. It sits out there. We use a welfare model. It's very expensive. It creates really, really, I think, unfortunate incentives for folks. And none of us want it. We all know we may need it, but none of us actually want it. And so that model can't be sustained over the long run. Then the final thing that I want to say, and I want to draw you to page 4 of the materials that we gave you, because this chart, I think, says it all about where we are. The question is, if you want a population to be healthy, what has the most effect? Which things make the most difference? And you can see by looking at this chart that behavior is the number one and most powerful force out there for assuring the health of the population. But look where we put our money. 88% of our money goes into treatment. Now, I know nobody wants to be Big Mama and Big Daddy, and we don't want the nanny state, but, you know, we also have to have built into our health care system some recognition of the power of behavior when it comes to health outcomes. The role of personal, individual, family responsibility has got to be respected in this, because there's no way out if we don't do the kind of a combined set. So our argument to you is that if you want to go after health care and really improve the health of our citizens, of our families, of our institutions, and of our finances, you've got to expect citizens to do their part, and I think Senator Durenberger just told you they're ready. One of the greatest sentences from his report was the citizens are ahead of the politicians on health care reform, and I believe that's true. And we have to call on citizens to do what's right for health and to do what's right for health care. The government has to be prepared to do its part. This is a chance for us to put ideology aside and just ask ourselves what works, what matters, what would make the most difference. Let's go do that, whatever it is. We've got to expect the docs and the insurance plans and the hospitals and so on to do their part, which is going to mean change. But if citizens are going to change and government policy is going to change, we can expect medicine and the people who practice medicine to change. And finally, we've got to expect all the other institutions of our community to be willing to change as well. Employers who buy insurance and deal with things like deductibles and co-pays all have to be part of the process of reinforcing a different approach to health care. Let me put it to you this way. If you believe, as I do, that this is the greatest threat we face, then I ask you to believe, as I do, that this year you have an unprecedented opportunity to do something about it. I've never in my adult life and in my life dealing with the Minnesota state government been able to use the word surplus out loud, because there never was one. But there is today. There's $1 billion going to be in the bank. What you choose to do with that $1 billion is going to make a huge difference. And I know everybody on earth has got an idea for you. And my idea is this. We got to invest to get the healthcare system we want. If you can define it, we've actually got today the resources to help invest to make it happen. Let's not let this opportunity go by, because it will not come back again. We're lucky that it worked out this time. But if we let it go and we let healthcare costs continue to rise at the rate they've been rising, the public dollars will never be enough. We'll never have this chance. So I not only want to urge you to do this, I want you to feel the sense that if we didn't get it done this year, it probably isn't going to get done. It's your opportunity, and I'm inviting you to grab it. Don't let it go. Wrestle it to the ground. Heck, if you have to go into 10 special sessions to get it done, it'll have been worth the effort, because it's so hard to do. As Senator Nurr would just tell you, he's been at this for 40 years. We've never had, at least in the state, an opportunity like the one we face today. But that's what a guy would tell you from wandering around the state and talking to folks and having a sense of urgency that I think they have about the importance of doing this. But you can't do this if you don't have a doctor in the house to give you the prescription. So Maureen Reed, who's been the chair and member of the Board of Regents at the university, was the medical director of Health Partners, is here with the 6 prescriptions that we're not claiming are the perfect, but we think they're better than what we're doing. And I'm sure there are people here that can make them even better, so go for it. Dr. Reed.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's nice to be with you here this afternoon. And as Peter said, I've been a physician practicing more than 20 years here in the Twin Cities community. And when I think about the healthcare crisis that we have on our hands today, I think of it similarly to the way I would think of going after and trying to treat and cure some very serious disease like cancer. And so if we were going to approach a disease like cancer, if, God forbid, one of us had cancer, a family member, and it were recommended that we have chemotherapy and radiation and surgery, as a physician, I would recommend that we do all three. That if you're really going for the cure of a bad disease, you do everything that is recommended. You don't do one or two and then roll the dice and hope that the patient survives or the patient is cured. And so when I think about a healthcare crisis that we have, I say there are 6 things that we have to do. There are 6 prescriptions that we need to do, and we've got to do them all. We can't just do the easy ones or the ones that are politically okay to do or the ones we like, because if we don't do them all, we run the risk of actually doing more damage than if we let everything alone. And we know that that is a crisis in and of itself. So what are the 6 prescriptions? We have put forth goals because we think you can't get to the cure unless you've got the goal. And the first prescription is to cut administrative costs in half. Senator Durenberger said it. In this country, we spend more than 20% of our health care dollars on administrative costs, and that's more than twice as much as any other country spends. And we just said, cut it in half. If, as Peter said, the $8 billion that the state of Minnesota government agencies spend on health care, the $8 billion, if 20% of that is tied up in administration, and we cut that in half, we would save $800 million a year. Well, what are some of the things that we would have to do in order to extract out that $800 million a year? We would need to simplify administrative systems. We need to have one set of forms, one set of codes, one set of procedures, one set of policies. We need complete interoperability in electronic transactions and electronic medical records. And we need streamlined regulation. And then we need another 5 or 6 things that will assure that we get to the goal of cutting administrative costs in half. That's goal number one. We got to start there. It's not adding to health. The second prescription is to improve the quality of care dramatically, and in so doing, set a goal for reducing the cost of care. We need to set a goal for ourselves in this state of 95% of our citizens getting best care for their diabetes and preventive services and heart disease, not 20%. We need to make sure in this state that we are paying for what works, and importantly, that we are not paying for what doesn't work. It is just astounding to me in healthcare that we pay for the stuff that's done twice and the stuff that never needed to be done in the first place and the stuff that's done to undo the stuff that never needed to be done in the first place. I mean, we would never stand for this in the airlines. If we bought a ticket to Phoenix and we, for some reason, wound up in Houston, we wouldn't expect Northwest Air to turn to us and say, okay, that's another $450 now to get you to your real destination. But in healthcare, we tolerate that. And in healthcare, it gives me no pleasure as a healthcare practitioner to say that 30% of what we do is either ineffective or unnecessary. So what we recommend is get half of that 30% out. And when you set that as a goal, you think very differently about what needs to be done. And you save another $700, $800, $900 million. It's a phenomenal amount of money that is tied up in the inefficient and excessive care. And I would say this. I do not know a nurse, a pharmacist, an administrator, a doctor, a therapist, anybody that gets up in the morning and says, gee, I wonder what I can do today to make healthcare unnecessary or ineffective. We have tremendous professionals in this state treating us when we get ill. But these folks are caught up in systems that were built, in some cases, in the late 19th century and in many cases in the early 20th century. And we need systems change in order to allow our trained and committed healthcare professionals to do the best for us. That's prescription number two. Cut the cost of care and improve the quality of care dramatically. Prescription number three, and you can't do it unless you do the first two, is to cover everybody. Cover everybody with some kind of a plan that covers the basics, that covers prevention, that covers chronic care, that covers generic drugs, that covers catastrophic care and mental health. Leave off the bells and whistles. We're not talking about bells and whistles here. Let's figure out what constitutes basic care, and then let's cover everybody with insurance. And we would recommend that it be mandatory. We would recommend, as Peter said in his family, insurance is mandatory, that those in Minnesota who can afford insurance and don't have it be required to purchase it. And those who don't have it and can't afford it, that the state would subsidize at some level for this basic level of care. This will also require us to take a look at what is basic care. That's prescription number three. And you can't do number three unless you do number one and number two. Prescription number four relates to personal responsibility. Now, if I choose to smoke, or if I choose not to get my high blood pressure cared for, you all and your constituents are going to wind up footing the bill for the choices that I have made. I would strongly recommend that we make sure that all of us have incentives for getting our preventive services done, for keeping our chronic conditions under control, to make it in our personal interest to do those kinds of things. The fifth prescription that we talk about is not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. It has to do with data availability, information on cost, on quality, on price. Senator Durdenberger talked about it. This is a no-brainer, and yet, geez, it seems to be hard, doesn't it? And the final prescription is public health. And you cannot do what needs to be done for Minnesotans at a cost they can afford unless we get really serious about public health. And I just draw your attention to two epidemics. One, the epidemic of the 20th century, which is tobacco, and it is still with us today. And we would recommend, and I would recommend, a state indoor workplace smoking ban. And I'd recommend an increase in the tobacco excise tax that is somewhat commensurate with the actual cost of smoking a pack of cigarettes. And in increasing that tax, you can easily, and I would recommend, buy down the provider tax. So there is no net increase. It is simply a shift of dollars coming from those who are in fact going to be incurring the cost. The second epidemic is a very puzzling one for all of us in healthcare and those of us outside of healthcare, and that's obesity. It's the epidemic of the 21st century. And we haven't even seen the tip of the iceberg on this one yet. And when we do, if we wait another 5 or 10 years before addressing this, we will be broke in a blink. So now is the time that we have to get very serious about investing in the kinds of research and action that's going to be required to stem the obesity epidemic. And that we aren't sitting, and that your colleagues 5 and 10 years from now aren't sitting saying, oh my gosh, what in the world are we going to do about this obesity epidemic and the dollars that it is sucking out of our system? So those are the 6 prescriptions. And, you know, we do have to do them all for the reason I mentioned. I would also say we have to do them now. Because for me, as I listen to Minnesotans, every month that we delay in doing these kinds of things, every month we delay, it's a month with a person's name on it. It's the name of somebody, could be your family member or your constituent, the name of somebody who died because they did not get best care. Every month we delay is a month with the name of a family on it. A family that went belly up because of some catastrophic illness or injury that they could not sustain. And every month that we delay is a month with the name of a business on it. A business that couldn't expand. A business that saw competitors in other parts of the world siphoning off its business because it couldn't withstand the cost of care. We need to do it all. And we need to do it now. And you are so lucky. You are so lucky to be at this juncture and to have the kinds of resources available in Minnesota and the right time now to seize this and do it all. With this kind of a legislature in these times, with this kind of an economic picture that Peter Hutchinson just laid out for you, is the perfect time to wrestle this beast. Go for the cure. It's just like cancer. Just go for the cure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments that anybody would like to? Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. My question is really around personal responsibility. I understand that we do need to spend more dollars and efforts doing preventative care, encouraging changes in behavior, looking at even in communities of color where lifestyle habits for generations need to start changing. But I'm always intrigued when individuals start talking about personal responsibility and especially looking at incentives. I'm curious to know what conversations and discussions have been had when you're talking about incentives for best care practices. How would one determine if someone is following their regimen in heart a disease or diabetes or asthma? And then also, how do you take into account of genetic issues, family history that may impact the individual who may be doing all that they're supposed to be doing, but regardless of that, their health care outcomes aren't what you thought they should be?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Ms.
Dr. Reed.
Representative Walker. This is a very important issue, and I'm very glad that you raised it. We are fortunate here in Minnesota that best care has been defined by the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement. So they have said for diabetes, these are the 5 things that you need to have under control. These are the 4 things that you need to have under control if you have heart disease, for instance. And it is a shared responsibility because a person with a chronic condition coming into the doctor and coming into the healthcare facility needs to get the right advice. So we believe you have to incentivize that clinic or that healthcare provider for giving the best recommendation. But we also believe that individuals need to follow through. We see a great example of this already in the communities, fairly widespread, but individuals that get health club memberships see a decrease of $10 a month or $20 a month if they go in and use the facility 8 times or 12 times a month. It's those kinds of fairly easy tracking mechanisms that we would be looking for in the conditions that really matter, like smoking, heart disease, and diabetes, and other preventive services like cancer screening, like mammograms and pap tests and colon cancer screening and that kind of thing. So it is a shared responsibility, and it is easy to track because clinics are already tracking it, or should be, and are already reporting on it.
Mr. Chair, let me follow up.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Reed, I guess in that was helpful, and I guess members, you guys will hear about my own personal health issues as we go along, but I guess I'll use myself for this, because asthma is a chronic disease, mm-hmm. and my allergist, who I visit several times a year to get on one of the steroids, constantly, to actually, when I first decided to run for office, told me I picked the wrong job. Because during the winter, I'm in an old building, and so it's not good for my health. And I actually have some allergies there, so the environment does not help me. And then in the summer, I'm in the community more, and the environment at any given time can trigger an episode. So I end up on a steroid at least twice a year, no matter what I do, but because of environment. How would best practices help me with an incentive, even if I'm doing everything that I'm supposed to be doing, that my doctor has said, when the environment is causing something, a reaction in me that I have no control over?
Dr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, you just nailed it. You're already doing everything you're supposed to be doing. So you get the check.
So Mr. Chair, so the outcomes would be, just if I checked off and said I was doing my Advair twice a day, I was doing my nose spray, my allergy medication, that, and I went to see my doctor for a follow-up, there, that's it, so there isn't any other, because his reporting would be, although I did what I was supposed to be doing, his reporting would be that I am medically in compliance of doing what I'm supposed to be doing. However, the outcomes for my health is not where his clinic's supposed to be. So how is that balanced?
Dr. Reed.
You can only be responsible for the things that you are responsible for. And so when you've done the right things, the asthma doesn't go away, or if you've done the right things for diabetes, diabetes doesn't go away. It's controlled most of the time, but it doesn't go away. So when you have managed the things that are manageable, you've nailed it.
Mr. Chair, I'll just close real quick. And I think this is something that we'll discuss more, members, as we go along, but just as the fine walk, because there are individuals that don't see it as you see it, Dr. Reed, that want to take it to that next step. Without understanding, there are things, just as you stated, that aren't in my control or may not be in the control of someone who has high cholesterol because of family genetic-ish reasonings, of things that no matter what you do, what you try, working with your physician on a regular basis, there's sometimes, because of your body chemistry or the environment that you're in, that you're still not going to be able to curtail and get better outcomes health-wise. But it doesn't mean that on a personal note that we shouldn't be trying to improve and working with our physicians and making sure that we move better. But I do think on a policy that we need to make sure that we walk that fine line of understanding individuals who may not be able to just be able to get that perfect outcome around some of the incentives.
Mr. Hutchinson.
I think you've got that spot on. The point here is not to get 100%, because we won't, for all kinds of reasons. Environmental reasons, genetic reasons, and so on. But the facts are that if every patient that your doctor has was as good as you are at following the advice and the protocol and so on, the results would be spectacular. The facts are most people don't do what you're doing. And so we do need to build a system that encourages the majority of the people to do the right thing all the time. We'll be better off collectively. It doesn't mean that it'll work 100% of the time, but it doesn't have to in order to get the kind of results that we need to get. And it never will. I mean, we should not kid ourselves that if everybody followed all the rules, we would all magically be fabulous. Because I'm one of those people with cholesterol. I mean, my cholesterol is never going to be much better than it is today. And of course, my doctor just says every time I come in, you're just degenerating. Don't worry about it. That may be true literally, but it's not the advice I need.
And members, I have Representative Huntley and Gottwald and Broad on the list, and I think that's all we're going to be able to take. And Representative Huntley.
Either one of the two. One of my main interests is how you pay providers for positive health outcomes, and the whole underlying thing in our healthcare system is the Medicare reimbursement rates, which don't pay for performance. What are your recommendations as to how we change the payment schemes for providers?
Dr. Reed.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, I would recommend that we start off in the place where the governor has landed with the QCARE, and that we raise the expectations for best care and we raise the reimbursement percentage for achieving best care. When I was at Health Partners, we started a pay-for-performance bonus system about 7 years ago, and it constituted about 0.5% of providers' reimbursement. It helped, but it wasn't enough. The amount that we need to pay when we're really talking about paying for performance needs to be much larger than that. But at the same time that we raise the payments for best care, we have to stop paying for what doesn't work. And we have too many examples, and I'll bet around this table here, there are 15 examples of things that you had to have done twice. You had a knee problem, you had surgery, didn't work, you had to have it done twice. We have to stop paying for the things that weren't done the first time right, or that should not have been done the first time. And so we need to work through the payment mechanisms so that we reduce that. And then to get to a point that Senator Dernberger made, we have to look very hard and very seriously at the issue of the medical arms race and what the excessive capacity that we have here in this state is doing to raise the cost of care. And we know from good studies it does not improve the quality of care. So we need to tackle it from those two angles, Representative Huntley.
Thank you.
Representative Roth. I think Representative Gottwald waved his question off.
Oh, I hope that doesn't set the standard for me, Mr. Chairman, but thank you very much. And I want to thank both of you, Mr. Hutchinson and Dr. Reed, and also Senator Dernberger. I really do think that the more ideas we have on the table, the better the outcomes are going to be for all Minnesotans in terms of how we reform the system, which is so desperately in need of reform. And Dr. Reed, you know, you used the idea of the cancer treatment. I'm pretty sure we're going to be spending all session getting a second opinion on your proposal. But I do like a lot of the ideas that you have on the table. A lot of them are very intriguing to me. One thing I'm trying to figure out is the cost drivers and the cost factors in your proposal. I think the first of your prescriptions was saving $900 million. The second was saving $900 million. The third was saving $110 net. I'm trying to figure out how you have to spend to create the savings. Maybe I misunderstood what your proposal was.
Dr. Reed?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Representative. The first prescription saves $800 million. The second prescription saves $900 million. The third prescription covering everybody costs. It costs some $500-600 million, depending on how you cover everybody. The last three prescriptions, we don't feel that there is a huge cost or savings, a direct savings associated with those. So you've got to go after the cost part. And I think this is where states like Massachusetts and California are actually going to be in some trouble in a year and a half or two, is that they haven't gone after the cost savings. Now, there's a problem that you can either do it all at once, which is what I would be advocating, is do the cost control on administration, do the cost control on care, and do the coverage all at once. Otherwise, you are always waiting. If you say, well, we're not going to do the coverage part until we get the costs under control, but, you know, that's kind of hard, so maybe we won't really do very much there. It's going to be forever before you will be able to do the coverage part. So it seems to me that it is imperative to do all of these things at once so that you've got the savings coming in at the same time that you're going to be shouldering greater expenses in the coverage of every Minnesotan.
Thank you, Dr. Reed and Mr. Hutchinson. We really appreciate it. And I'm sure we'll be in touch with all three of you as we go forward. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Julie Sonier from the Department of Health is going to get at some of the things, your cost drivers that the Department of Health has looked at. And as she's coming up, I did want to re-announce, now that more members are here, Freedom to Breathe is on Thursday, and we're going to use, because it's... because the time is going to be pressed with testifiers, et cetera, that we have amendments in at 24 hours in advance. So by 2:15 tomorrow, if we could have our amendments to Ursula or Jen, that would be great. And we'll then make them available to everybody going forward. And Representative Helm, are you going to have any offers amendments, do you know? Or is it going to be the bill as it's presented?
I prefer if the bill never got amended.
Okay. So what you see on the computer is what will be presented. Okay. And would Representative Walker move the minutes from... Any questions? All in favor? Say aye. All opposed? The minutes from January 25th are adopted. All right. Ms. Sonier, whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Sonier, and I direct the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. While we're getting the computer ready, I'll just let you know that I'm here today to present some information on healthcare cost trends in Minnesota and the drivers of those recent trends. My presentation today will focus primarily on the results of an analysis of trends in Minnesota's private health insurance markets that's done by the Health Economics Program each year. Just as a quick overview of the presentation today, I'll be presenting information on these trends in private health insurance markets in terms of premium growth, in terms of the underlying costs which are driving that premium growth. I'll provide some comparison to other economic indicators, and I'll talk a bit about the healthcare services that are contributing to spending growth. As time allows, I'll also provide some more detailed examples related to cost drivers, specifically related to aging and demographics, lifestyle and behavior, and technology, which are issues that have already been touched on earlier today. This first chart that's up on the screen shows annual increases in health insurance premiums, along with annual increases in the amounts that are actually spent on behalf of enrollees in Minnesota's private health insurance market. So in the chart, the premiums per person are shown in blue, and the spending per person is shown in gray. A few things that are noteworthy about the chart is, first, is that premiums were not keeping up with spending growth during the mid-1990s, from about 1995 to 1997. Premiums began to rise more quickly around 1998, but at the same time, so did underlying spending. And so as a result, premiums still hadn't quite caught up to where costs were. After several years of double-digit premium growth in 2005 was only 4.5% per person, and this was the slowest rate that Minnesota has seen since 1997. Also of note is that growth in underlying costs, which are the gray bars in the chart, has slowed for each of the past 3 years. And this is the most important indicator for thinking about where our health insurance premiums likely to head in the future. As the previous chart showed, sometimes premiums grow faster than actual spending, and sometimes they're slower. I did note earlier that premiums weren't keeping pace with cost growth in the mid-1990s, and that's reflected in this chart that shows the difference in premiums and spending per person. So between 1996 and 1999, health plans' costs per person were higher than premiums. In the late 1990s, as premiums began to increase more rapidly than costs, that situation began to reverse so that by 2001, premiums exceeded costs by about 4%. Over the long run, we would expect to see that premiums and spending should be roughly equal, but in the short run, there are these cycles where premiums exceed costs in some years and are lower than costs in others. This next chart compares the trend in health plans spending per enrollee to other economic indicators. So the red line on this chart, which isn't very visible on the screen, but it's the top line, shows the trend in cost per person, and these are the costs per person that are incurred by health plans on behalf of people with private insurance. This does not include amounts that enrollees pay themselves, such as deductibles and copayments. Starting around 1998, there was a real divergence in healthcare costs compared to the other economic indicators that are shown here, which are per capita income, average wages, and general inflation. This gap has narrowed over the past few years, but it's still the case that healthcare spending is growing substantially faster than income and wages, and as well as inflation. As I mentioned, the previous...
Representative Huntley has a question on that last
one. So on your, Mr. Chairman, is there data that shows what the total spending is? I mean, there's premiums, plus then there's copays and deductibles and all that. And we all know that the copays and deductibles are rising rather rapidly. Is there data on that available?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, yes, there is, and I think that's what is reflected in the chart that is I'm about to talk about.
Uh-oh.
So if it doesn't answer your question, please tell
them. Ms. Sonier, thanks.
The previous chart showed only the trends in the costs that were incurred by the private health insurance plans, but we do know that one strategy employers have used to keep premium growth as low as possible is to switch to health plans that require higher enrollee cost sharing, such as higher deductibles or copayments. What this chart does is show that the amounts that are spent by health plans and enrollees together to look at the trend in total costs. So adding in the amounts that enrollees pay out of their own pockets, total health care spending per person who has private health insurance was over $3,700 per person in 2005. This is a 67% increase over 5 years earlier. And the average amounts that enrollees paid out of their own pockets more than doubled during this time, and their share of the total bill that was paid increased from 10% to 13%.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Sonier. All of these charts say it's for the fully insured private market, and you reference health plans. Could you just clarify for us who that includes, who it doesn't, and what percentage of the market it is? Because I know, anyhow, if you could clarify just who we're talking about in these slides, that would be great.
Ms. Sonia.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, the fully insured private market is the market for people who buy health insurance coverage, actually buy policies from health plans. There's another segment of the market which is mainly large employers, but they are employers that offer health coverage but choose to retain the risk for paying for claims themselves. Very often they will hire health plans as administrators for those claims. So what this data has is because it's the data that's available to the department is it is information on that fully insured segment of the market. We do know from national data that the fully insured markets and the self-insured markets are very similar, so we believe it's accurate to say that this trend is representative of the private health insurance market as a whole.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that, does that include then indemnity products, HMO products, high deductible health plans, I mean, anything that an individual could buy on their own?
Ms. Sutter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, yes, it includes all private health insurance, both employer-based and individually purchased.
Thank you.
In addition to tracking growth in health insurance premiums and the underlying costs, one of the things that we also do is analyze the drivers of spending growth by type of health care service. There are two key factors that influence. The first is the share of total spending that's accounted for by each service to start with. So, for example, hospital and physician services each account for about one-third of total spending for people who have private health insurance. And so these usually account for a large share of the growth because they are large to start with. The second factor is the differences in the growth rates of spending for different services, and that's shown on the next slide. The blue bars at the left-hand side of this chart show annual growth rates from 2003 to 2005 by category of service. During this time, the fastest growing category of service was outpatient hospital services, which were growing at 13.8% per year. This accounted for about one quarter of total spending growth during this period. Inpatient hospital services, although they grew less rapidly, also accounted for a large share of growth because they're a large share of spending to start with. And interestingly, physician services during this time period had the slowest growth rate, about 3.9% per year, but they accounted for nearly one-fifth of total spending growth because it's a large category of spending. Compared to the previous two-year period, and this information is not shown on the chart, just about every category of spending showed slower growth, and so the slowdown in spending growth that we've seen is fairly broad-based across all services. There are two services in particular, though, that have shown the largest declines, and those are prescription drug spending and physician services. Beyond the question of how much money is being spent,
On that last slide, growth in outpatient is a shift from inpatient hospital services?
Mr. Chair, that's likely the case.
Okay. So it doesn't necessarily mean the cost per services have gone up, although that's probably true, too.
Mr. Chair, it is, right. So it accounts for both. When spending shifts across services, you'll see higher growth in the service that it shifted to and lower growth than the others. So some of that high growth in outpatient services does likely reflect a shift in the settings where patients receive care.
Cool. Thank you.
Beyond the question of how much is being spent, how fast it's growing, and what services are driving healthcare spending growth, there are many more detailed questions that can be asked, such as whether the spending growth is being caused by changes in price, changes in the amount of services provided, changes in the types of services that are being provided, or some combination of those factors. And at an even more detailed level, there's a number of factors that you can think of as driving changes in price versus driving changes in quantity. So those include, for example, demographic change, lifestyle behavior, market structure, labor costs, technology, all sorts of things. And I wanted to spend just a couple of minutes, if there's time, talking about three of those in particular, because they get a lot of attention, and they also have come up already earlier today. With the aging of the baby boomers, Minnesota's population as a whole is getting older. But the impact of this trend to date on demand for healthcare services is not as large yet as many people think it has been. The chart that's up on the screen now shows how Minnesota's age distribution shifted between 1990 and 2000 and how it's projected to change by the year 2030. During the 1990s, the major shift that occurred was an increase in the percent of the population that was ages 35 to 59, and a decrease in the number of young adults as a share of the population. In the coming decades, the major shift is expected to be a large increase in the share of the population that's over age 60. So, for example, over a quarter of Minnesota's population will be 60 years old or older by 2030, compared to just 16% in 2000. Looking at this information a slightly different way, this chart shows projected growth rates by age group, and I think it provides an even more dramatic example of how the state's population is aging. While the population over age 60 will more than double by 2030, the rest of the state's population will only grow by about 12%. So why does aging matter? One reason is because the use of healthcare services and also healthcare spending varies a lot by age. This information is national data, but it shows that people ages 55 to 64 tend to spend about twice as much on average as what the rest of the non-elderly population spends on a per-person basis. So as more of the baby boom generation enters the age group that have dramatically higher healthcare spending, there'll be implications for both the amount of capacity that's needed in the healthcare delivery system and as well as for healthcare costs. Turning next to the topic of how lifestyle and behavior can be a driver of healthcare costs, one of the most common examples that's used here is how the increasing prevalence of obesity...
I'm sorry to interrupt. On that last slide, is most of that difference, that's not just the kind of pure medical cost services that we talk about, but the long-term care piece of it too? I mean, can you separate that out a little bit, if that's helpful?
Mr. Chair, this data that's in this chart is actually reflective only of the non-institutionalized population, and so if you were to add nursing home spending, for example, the differences would be even larger.
All right, thank you.
One of the most common examples that's used as an example of how lifestyle and behavior can be a healthcare cost driver is the increasing prevalence of obesity and how that's affecting the use of healthcare services and overall costs. What the map that's up on the screen shows now is the percentage of the adult population that was obese by state in 1990. The next series of maps will show how that's changed over the past 15 years. And as the colors get darker, what you see is that obesity rates are increasing by states, and eventually we need new colors. We need orange, and now we need red. And so it's a dramatic illustration of how much and how rapidly this change has taken place, and it really does have substantial implications for healthcare costs. So Just show the charts that show the increasing prevalence of obesity. There's a national research study that's been done that's tried to estimate, well, how much impact has this had on healthcare spending to date? And it used data from 1987 and 2001 and estimated that obesity prevalence during that time period increased by about 10.3 percentage points, while the prevalence of the normal weight population declined. A second thing that was noted in this study is that not only was there increasing prevalence of this problem, but there's a widening gap in healthcare spending per person for the obese population versus the normal weight population. And as a result of both of these factors combined, these researchers estimated that obesity-related health spending accounted for over a quarter of per capita health spending increases during this 14-year period. And its share of increases in heart disease spending and diabetes-related spending were even higher.
Awesome. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I'm going back. It took me two slides to get over the staggering numbers on those long-term care and health care costs in 2030. I'm wondering if you have, I look at these two charts back on page six, and is it possible, do you have the age cohorts in? Do you have already a chart that does the multipliers for the costs of providing care versus the expected populations in 2030? I'm just kind of curious if, you know, what type of bill the state is looking at that point, just an estimation.
Ms. Steiner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, we have not done that calculation. It's certainly something that we can combine the demographic projections and answer the question. If healthcare spending patterns were the same in 2030 as they were in 2000, mm-hmm. hypothetically, what kind of a difference would that make?
That would be really useful.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and if we could have a secondary piece of that and just add on the long-term care costs then on top of that, let's be open about what we're facing. So if we could get those two pieces, that'd be great. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Sonia.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to provide that information. I think we're going to have to put a lot of caveats on it to emphasize that it's highly theoretical, just an example of what might happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Just finally wanted to spend a minute talking about technology as a healthcare cost driver. There are a lot of ways that advances in technology can be reflected in the healthcare system. One is in better diagnosis. You get more cases identified of a specific kind of disease. You can also get better treatment. So you have more of the cases that exist that are treatable than previously existed. And in theory, you can get either higher or lower cost per treated case. Very often, it's higher cost per case. Most economists will agree that advances in technology have accounted for a majority of increases in healthcare spending over time. Recently, we have seen renewed policy concerns about a medical arms race, and that's been mentioned already a couple of times today. Just as a reminder to the committee, we have an upcoming report to the legislature on medical facilities, so we'll have more information on that topic in a couple of weeks. In a recent book by one of the leading researchers on the impact of technology on healthcare spending, Harvard economist David Cutler found that, in general, technological advance has been worth it in terms of benefits that exceed costs when technology is appropriately applied. However, he also discusses pervasive problems in the healthcare system, such as the fact that there are many, many opportunities to prevent the need for high-tech interventions that are missed, and prevalence of overuse, underuse, and misuse of care that have also been discussed earlier today. His final bottom line is that you get what you pay for. So the system that we have today pays well for intensive interventions and doesn't pay well for care management and prevention. And one of the things that he concludes is that we shouldn't therefore be surprised that we have an emphasis on high-tech intervention and not so much emphasis on the upfront care. So just to quickly summarize the presentation, what we found is that health insurance premiums and underlying cost growth in the state have both slowed recently, which is good news. However, they're still growing more rapidly than most of the other economic indicators that we compare them to. The slowdown occurred across most services, but especially for prescription drugs and physician services. And finally, not all of the factors that influence healthcare use and spending can be influenced by policy, but there are opportunities potentially to make better use of resources. The final slide just has my contact information in case there are any follow-up questions. This concludes my presentation. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, and that was really that was great, and thanks for speaking it along too. That was wonderful. I did. Any thoughts on why prescription drugs and physician services are growing more slowly?
Mr. Chair, we do know that these are consistent with national trends. Specifically for prescription drugs, there are a few factors. One is that the introduction of new sort of blockbuster drugs has slowed, and so there's not as much new drugs entering the system and raising spending as previously. There have been a number of highly publicized cases where drugs have been taken off the market. There's been a very strong and rapid shift towards the use of more generic drugs, and that's also influencing growth for prescription drugs.
Thank you. Representative Huntley.
This is a question. Comment, not a question, but I'm glad to see you reporting about David Cutler's book, and he's the only person that I know of that's talked about the benefit of health care to the economy. And it's kind of interesting. He and most economists actually agree that it's worth about $100,000 a year to the economy for every year of added life to somebody that gets back in the workforce. And in a more personal case, my wife had an incident that cost $150,000 of hospital care. But she said almost 7 years now back in the workforce. And so it more than paid for itself just to the economy. So sometimes we get something for what we pay for.
That's right. Well, that's a good note to end on. And thank you, members, for your attention, and thank you for coming, Ms. Steiner. We're adjourned.